and welcome to Health Fact versus Fiction, brought to you by HCA Healthcare UK. I'm Anna Richardson, and this is the podcast where we uncover the truths and bust the myths about your health with some of the country's leading consultants. You can't open a newspaper, a magazine, or read a news article online without seeing pictures of celebrities with their beautiful hair and their beautiful skin. We're conditioned from a very early age to believe that the way we look really matters. And because of that, it has a huge impact on our self-esteem. So in this episode, we're going to try to understand how to keep the largest organ in our body not only pampered, but healthy too. We are, of course, talking about skin. Later, we're going to be talking to the one and only Denise Van Outen about how she and now her daughter cope with the skin condition eczema. But before that, and with me throughout the episode, is Dr. Sharon Wong. Sharon is a consultant dermatologist and works at HCA Healthcare UK's London Bridge Hospital. Sharon, hello.
Hello.
Welcome. Can I just say, I mean, we've got Denise and Sharon here. Your skin and your hair, gorgeous.
We've been in makeup for 3 hours. It's been a long process.
I was going to say,
transformation.
You can tell that you're a consultant dermatologist because you are literally flawless. But first of all, I'm going to just put you on the spot a little bit, Sharon, because we like to start all of our podcasts with some myth busting. And I have to say, when it comes to skin and hair, there is a lot of myths floating around. So can you tell me whether the following statements are health fact or health fiction? Are you ready?
I am ready.
No pressure. Snake oil makes your hair grow. Fact or fiction?
It is most definitely fiction.
No, correct. There's a trickier one now.
Okay. All right.
A sun cream that says SPF 50 is enough to protect your skin from cancer.
That is also fiction.
No!
It is.
How come?
It's because SPF only covers UVB. It doesn't cover UVA. And UVA is just as damaging to the DNA in your skin cells as UVB. So you need broad spectrum, which means it has to cover UVA and UVB. So if you pick up a bottle of sunscreen and it only says SPF, it only covers you for UVB. You need to look out for the logo. You need to look out for the logo that says UVA, and it's got a little star rating, and you need to choose that's one that's 4 or 5 stars.
Wow, never knew that.
Okay. Common balding only happens to men, fact or fiction?
Fiction.
Really?
Yes.
What, common balding?
Yes, yes, absolutely. So there's loads of myths about common balding, that men only get it, that you can only get it from your maternal grandfather. All of that is false.
So how do you get it then? I mean, where does it come from?
Well, it does come from genetics, but there's not just one gene. That's a bit too oversimplistic. And you have to look at both sides of your family. And anyone who does have thinning or receding hairline, do ask them, when did they start noticing that? Because the earlier that they have developed noticeable thinning, the stronger that genetic trait could be to other members of the family.
Okay. Well, Sharon, let's start now with just how important our skin and hair is to us, and particularly when it comes to how we feel about ourselves, because I think it's so wrapped up, isn't it, in our identity and our self-esteem. So we know that newspapers and magazines put the onus on having beautiful bronze skin and, of course, you know, long, strong, healthy hair.
Yes.
It puts an awful lot of pressure on people, doesn't it?
Absolutely, and I think I really don't envy the younger generation now, because we're in this sort of era where it's so easy to change images and just with a push of a button, you've got a filter and you've got, you know, a completely airbrushed skin. And all of this is obviously just being portrayed and bombarded to people on various platforms constantly. So the pressure to look a certain way is just always there. And anything short of is just not good enough. And that pressure is enormous. And that's equally for both sexes.
And is this being reflected in your clinic at all? Are you seeing more and more people really worrying about needing to have flawless skin and flawless hair?
Yes, absolutely. And things which actually are relatively mild and can be treated with over-the-counter products, people are asking for quite strong treatments on the one extreme.
Really? Yes. So give me an example of that.
So, for example, acne, which of course we know can cause pigmentation and scarring, but actually if it's very mild, and I am seeing a lot of young people with quite mild acne, and there are a lot of over-the-counter products which have got very good and effective anti-acne ingredients, can be used, but they're asking for very strong medications like Roaccutane, for example, which really has a clear indication for more severe scarring acne acne, which isn't shifting with the more standard treatments. So people are asking for quite extreme treatments for things which are at the mild end of the spectrum.
Well, again, we were talking about myths earlier on around skin and hair. And there are a lot of myths around how we should care for our skin and for our hair. So, for example, I know that certainly when I was younger in the 80s, we used to talk about putting olive oil on your skin when you were suntanning. Does that work? Does that moisturise? And does it help a tan?
Well, it certainly helps you burn. And I think that is the problem. Back then, the public health awareness about sun safety wasn't there. And everybody thought that the bronzed appearance was associated with health. And of course, we know that with that comes that higher risk of skin cancer. And those warnings just weren't there in the public domain, not to the same extent as it is now. But as a moisturiser, no. I mean, people want to go for natural products. I understand the sentiment behind it, but actually there isn't really any evidence behind using the natural oils as your moisturiser, particularly if you've got dry skin problems like eczema or psoriasis.
Really? I mean, it's counterintuitive, isn't it? Because you would think that if you have very dry skin, that you would turn to an oil. But you're saying, no, that doesn't necessarily
work. Actually, studies that have looked at using things like sunflower seed oil, olive oil and coconut oil on children who are at risk of developing eczema actually found that olive oil can sometimes actually break down the skin barrier and cause worsening of their eczema. So natural doesn't always mean safer. And we certainly, as dermatologists, see awful reactions to very natural products like fragrances, for example, or flower extracts. We see awful allergic eczema as a result of it when people are allergic to perfumes, for example.
Really? Well, this is a real pet topic of mine, actually, because I also suffer with eczema. I know we're going to talk about it shortly, and that's also why Denise is here. But I'm intrigued by that, because we tend to think, don't we, that if it's natural, if it's organic, it's going to be gentle, it's going to be good for us. However, hold that thought, okay. Because my other pet topic is, of course, ageing. Do anti-ageing creams work?
I think in the beauty industry, which obviously this aspect of dermatology bridges onto, it's very difficult to ignore a lot of the marketing ploys, for example, and there are so many products out there. The key thing is knowing what the main active ingredients are in your anti-aging cream. And really, when you cut out all the rubbish and all the background noise and all the marketing, it really just boils down to a few key things.
Which I'm going to note of now. So the key ingredients are...
Sunscreen, which we've obviously already touched upon. Sun is the biggest aging factor on your skin, the external aging factor. There are, of course, internal aging factors like your genetics, etc. But external aging factors, the sun is the biggest one. So you need your SPF of 50 and UVA 4 or 5 star plus, and to apply that every day. You know, even on a cloudy day, 80% of the UV gets through cloud cover. So if you're talking about it on a daily basis, cumulative sun damage, yes, that will start causing wrinkles, skin aging, etc. So sunscreen is an absolute must. And if you're going to be really good about it, even on a daily basis in your mid-20s onwards. If you're really wanting to push back the onset of ageing, that's really the time to start incorporating it.
Missed that boat.
A bit late.
Never too late.
So I lived on a sunbid, didn't you, in the early 90s? Well, it was like sunbeds, tanning.
Yeah, you had to be orange, didn't you?
Well, you see, that is the thing. It was always put forward through advertising that bronzed skin is beautiful, it's healthy, it's associated with a positive.
It's because of Baywatch, let's face it.
Well, yes, exactly. And I just don't think the warning signs were there. They are better now, for sure, and sun safety
awareness. So obviously
awareness.
Avoid the sun or wear your broad-spectrum UVA, UVB protection. So what else should I be looking for in my anti-aging cream?
So the cornerstone of anti-aging is retinols.
Is that vitamin A?
Yeah, so it's a vitamin A derivative, which is the retinols are available over-the-counter. Retinoids, which gets a little bit confusing, is another derivative of vitamin A, but it's a prescription strength. So if you've got real sort of pigmentation problems and you need a stronger vitamin A derivative, you'd get a prescription strength retinoid.
Yes.
So, but you can get lots of retinols, which are over-the-counter strength. And again, incorporating that into your skincare routine in the evening, because retinols can make you sun sensitive, from your sort of late 20s, early 30s onwards on a nightly basis is really helpful. And that can help to improve collagen production. It can also help, you know, with the cell turnover. So you continue to get the sort of refreshed look to your complexion.
And Are they good enough, the creams that you get over the counter? Are they really, you know, I mean, I know they're known as sort of cosmeceuticals, but are they strong enough to make a difference?
Yes, they are, and it's more to do with consistency. So these are the active ingredients. So your sunscreen, the retinols on a nightly basis. And then the third thing that I tend to use is as well some antioxidants, and it's vitamin C that we tend to go for, about 10 to 15% of vitamin C. There is very good evidence that air pollution can accelerate the aging in the skin. So it is really important, especially in big cities like London, to incorporate an antioxidant in your skincare routine.
So far, what we've learned, Sharon, is we're all living in London and we've been wearing the wrong sunscreen. Thanks. How important is it in terms of diet, what we eat and drink? How does that affect our skin? Because it is the biggest organ.
It is. And, you know, I think historically dermatologists used to just poo-poo the idea of diet being related to skin disease and skin health. And I think that tune is changing, and there's definitely evidence to back certain foods that might aggravate underlying skin problems, specifically things like aging. So we know that refined sugars, highly processed foods, a very starch-based diet actually can cause what we call glycation. So it starts to firm up and make the collagen in your skin really stiff. So collagen's there as the main scaffolding protein in your skin, which gives it that sort of bounce and elasticity of youthful skin. So what happens with this particular sort of high-carb, refined sugar diet is that it just makes the collagen that much more stiff. Mm. So it doesn't function very well as a scaffolding protein. So that can accelerate aging. The other thing it has been related to as well is acne. So again, highly refined sugars can exacerbate acne in some patients. And the new buzzword really is on the gut microbiome and probiotics. That's a very big research topic now. And especially in light of things like eczema. So there is some evidence to support that actually if you improve the amount of good bacteria that your gut's immune system is exposed to by using probiotics, it can help inflammatory problems like eczema.
Which brings me perfectly to our guest today, which is, of course, the actress, the presenter, the all-round superstar, Denise Van Outen.
Super itchy.
super itchy superstar. Denise, who's been living with eczema since she was a child, and I had absolutely no idea, because, again, when you look at your face and your skin, it's perfect.
Well, it's so not quite perfect. It flares up at certain times of the year. So I had it worse when I was a child. And then I kind of grew out of it a bit. And then I got it again when I was on my late teens. It started to flare up again. But I kind of get it. It's not consistent. So I never know when it's going to strike. Whereas my daughter's only 8, but she's had it since she was a baby. And it seems to be quite consistent. It's pretty much every winter. So I think it is weather related, because we took a lot of things out of her diet when she was younger.
Okay. So we know that your daughter, and she's 8, isn't she?
She's 8, yes.
We know that she has it.
Yes.
So when she was born, did it manifest immediately then?
No, she was probably, I think, she was a few months old. And she was born in the May, and so in the winter, and she was really bad. I mean, it was to the point where I was beside myself, because I didn't know what to do with her, because I couldn't put her in a bath, or she was, you know, the wounds were so open that they would bleed.
Oh, that's awful.
She was really, really bad. And so we changed her diet, because we cut out all dairy. That seemed to help, but not for very long. Mm-hmm. And then it kind of came back again. I mean, we tried everything. And again, like you said, olive oil. You read online, don't you, about what to do, mm-hmm. and various creams, a lot of over-the-counter creams that couldn't work. So in the end, she's kind of grown out of it a little bit. It's not as bad, but we've managed to kind of get on top of it, I think. So you know when you know it's going to flare up, we have got certain creams that we found, I don't want to mention certain brands, that have helped. Mm. So we are aware of it. And as soon as the weather starts to change, stressful situations, you know, I make sure she's got it on her skin, so I put something in a bath, and you just have to kind of manage it, really.
Oh, poor little mite.
Yeah, it's horrible.
And so for you, how old were you when you realised that?
I was probably about my daughter's age now. I mean, it wasn't something that I had as a baby. It was more when I got to her age. Mm. But it affected everything. You know, you'd be in swimming club and I didn't want to go swimming. Mm. And what other kids say, because it get really red and itchy. Mm. And I never had it all over my body. I'd get in certain patches, in which it still comes back in those same places. So it's my hands, around my eyes. I get it really quite badly.
Yes.
Around my mouth. And people were never aware of it. And even when I was doing like the Big Breakfast in the 90s.
Yeah, I remember, yeah.
And obviously that was a show where I was up really early. I don't think I ever got much sleep. So it would flare up quite a lot. And people would, you know, I'd be interviewing somebody and they'd go to me, oh, you look really tired. Because it looked like I had lots of lines around my eyes, but my skin was so dry. And of course, you're putting makeup over it and it just makes everything so much worse.
Well, I was going to say, obviously, you know, working in television, you have to wear so much slab. Yeah. Does that aggravate your skin and your eczema?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it does make it a lot worse. And my hands, I get my hands are always quite bad. They get really, really cracked and really sore.
So I'm really interested in this because I've just got a flare-up at the moment around my skin, around the nostrils, you know, around my mouth and around my nose. And I can't work out what it is, what's triggered it. So because I've not had it for quite a few years, actually. Sure. So for you, Denise, you think it's moving into the winter?
I think it's stress, definitely. I get a flare-up. We just moved house, so we've had quite a stressful summer. I've been all right, actually, touch wood, for now. But... you know, I just know as soon as the weather turns cold, that's when it starts. And it's exactly the same for my daughter.
Mm. That's absolutely bizarre. So, Sharon, just talk to us a little bit more about eczema and what the causes are. Because Allergy UK claims that up to 15 million people in Britain could be living with it, which is a vast number of people. So what exactly causes it?
So, I mean, eczema is a very common condition. It does form a big bulk of the work of the dermatologist. So about 1 in 5 children, about 1 in 12 adults will have eczema at any one time. And it manifests as dry, itchy, flaky patches of skin. And the commonest type of eczema is called atopic eczema, which has predominantly a genetic component behind it. And it's associated with things like asthma and hay fever. And those sorts of conditions may run in members of your family. So somebody might have a touch of hay fever, another family member might have a bit of asthma, you have a bit of eczema. But they are genetically related. And as Denise was saying, there are very common trigger factors. So very often you might carry the sort of genetic risk, but you've never had eczema before. But when there is that combination of that genetic risk with those triggers, like extreme stress or changes of weather, it brings it out. And it is just so intentionally itchy. I've lived with it. And that's part of the reason why I got into dermatology, actually, was because I was interested. And most dermatologists have had skin problems, which is why we got into the subject. And I've had it since I was a baby. And for me, again, it was stress and weather change. So this time of year, when it turns cooler, the central heating is on, the rooms are hot and dry, it's so dry, and that just starts off the whole process.
And is it common that it comes back to the same area? Because I always get it, sort of, like I said, my hands around my mouth, my eyes. Yeah. My sister gets it, but she just gets it just on her hands.
Yes.
But gets it really badly. Her hands just crack.
Yeah.
But nowhere else.
Hot spots for individuals that the eczema seems to keep wanting to go back to.
But can it be managed?
Absolutely, yes. I think when you treat eczema, and if you've lived with it for so long, you know when it's about to happen. And you preemptively take precautions and start your treatment early. And absolutely, moisturising is key. It's not just an emollient. There is really good evidence that if you start and continue conditioning your skin with a good moisturiser, you can actually reduce the frequency of your flare-ups and spread them out. And also, if it does become very inflamed and itchy, you do need some prescription treatments, usually some cortisone, just to settle down the itching and to break that cycle. The way I explain it to patients is that you've got to treat eczema a bit like a fire. So if you don't put it out in small areas, it very quickly does start to spread to other parts of the body.
So, I mean, now we're going back to the creams again, because we're saying that you need to moisturise your skin. And yet if you have got eczema, and, you know, in particular, as I say, I've got it on my face at the moment, it's really sort of sore. Yes. I'm really worried about what cream to put on it, because it's going to irritate it. So when you say moisturise it, what sort of creams should you be putting on eczema?
So you definitely should be avoiding anything that's got fragrance. When your eczema is active, you've got essentially a broken down barrier. Your skin is there as a barrier. When you've got active eczema, there are gaps in the skin, which does mean that anything like fragrances, preservatives can get in and cause worsening sensitivity and irritation. So you want to keep skincare really simple, but you should be going for quite a thick product that has a liquid paraffin base, so a bit more like a Vaseline base, because that will function as the barrier whilst your skin is trying to repair.
So Denise, for you and certainly your daughter, what adjustments have you had to make in terms of managing her condition? Because she's so young, really.
Yes.
She won't know how to manage it herself.
Do you know, she's actually quite good because she knows, because she's obviously had it since she was a baby. So I have to, she gets herself ready now. So I say to her, make sure you put all your cream on, and she does do it. You know, and she takes the time to do it because I think she had it so bad when she was little that she can remember, you know, at times she missed out on so many things because it's the confidence side of it as well. You know, when kids are little and they're going to do PE and they have to get undressed and what other kids say and, you know, they don't really understand it. So she's kind of really aware of it now, which is good. But we do, like, as soon as the season changes, we start to put creams and things into her bath water and make sure she puts all her moisturiser on. She's the one reminding me. I forget.
Really? And do you find that you're having to eliminate things from your diet? You were saying earlier on that dairy, but then it sort of flares back up again.
Yeah. We did. She went on a soy-based diet when she was little, and that worked. But like I said, we gradually reintroduced dairy, and it's not so bad. I found now it's more weather-related, and for me, it's stress-related.
Right. So really, Sharon, not so much to do with your diet. It's weather and stress.
It can be diet, but in a small percentage of people. But it's also tricky with children because their immune systems aren't yet mature. So very often children who do find that, you know, their parents do find that they have certain sensitivities or their eczema gets worse with dairy, they often find that they can grow out of those intolerances and allergies as they grow older and as their immune system develops. So an allergy from a very early age doesn't necessarily mean that it will continue. But certainly for a small percentage of people with eczema, food can be a trigger.
Let's widen discussion slightly and talk about acne. Mm-hmm. So we've all been through those awkward, spotty teenage years. And we assume that obviously we're going to grow out of it. But actually for adults, acne can be a real problem, can't it?
Absolutely. I think we're changing the way that we're thinking about acne. We always used to think it's just a teenage problem. Yeah. You'll grow out of it by your 20s. But we see huge numbers of adult acne. So acne that's either started as a teenager and has persisted well into and beyond your 20s, or acne that's appeared the first time in your 20s and never really much as a teenager. And we're definitely seeing more of it as dermatologists, more so in women.
So what's the cause then?
Well, acne is more of a complex condition. It's not just your hormones, as is often assumed, because its onset is usually is puberty. It's more that you've probably got a genetic risk underlying more persistent acne. But on top of that, there are certain aggravating factors like lifestyle choices, so stress, diet, as we'd mentioned before, but also hormones. And that might be the reason why a lot of women are getting a lot of adult acne. So we go through a lot of periods of times in our lives where we have big fluctuations in sex hormones. So stopping, starting, changing the contraceptive pill, pregnancy, menopause, all of these are big changes in our hormonal profile. And of course, there is that condition called polycystic ovarian syndrome, where you naturally produce more male hormone. And of course, that drives the whole greasy skin, acne, etc. So it's complex, but there are multiple factors involved.
I'm now just utterly mesmerised by this because, again, I'm thinking back to the one and only time I've ever had spotty skin, because my skin's normally quite good, was actually a few years ago in my early 40s, where suddenly I just had a massive breakout of loads of spots. So, again, you're saying it's due to a sort of hormonal disruption?
Yes, in a lot of people. Yes, in a lot of people. And other people, it could be changes in lifestyle, it could be stress, and also peripheral factors, things like makeup products and skincare routines. A lot of people are using the wrong things, which may be aggravating their acne.
Oh, interesting. And Denise, did you ever have it?
I was quite spotty as a teenager, but I haven't had it since. But it was never really severe. My niece has got quite bad acne, so she has to have treatment for her skin.
So again, there's a genetic link, potentially.
And my sister actually has had it as well, adult acne as well.
So it's really common. Do you want to squeeze the spots?
I do. I never really notice it, to be honest. You know, when you don't, I never look at things like that. But she's really conscious of it, and I do understand how it makes her feel.
Yeah.
But hers is obviously hormone related. Mm-hmm. But you're saying it's because it's a surge in the male hormone. So is it more testosterone?
Yes.
Right,
so
okay.
So testosterone, or the sort of umbrella term for male hormones, is androgens. So, for example, in menopause, the natural changes are such that your estrogen levels drop and the relative proportion proportion of male hormones or androgens go up, which is why you can, in some patients, get a bit of acne around the time of the menopause, or you get this odd wispy hair on the chin and that sort of thing.
My friend suddenly got a hair on her chin.
Yes.
Well, me and the girls in production talk about this earlier on. We've all got massive bushy beards on our chins. So is that our age? And it's because the androgens have gone up.
Yes, so around that time when you're going through perimenopausal changes, menopausal changes, you do get that difference.
Only the listeners could see what beautiful skin but massive beards. Well, and why shouldn't I pop my spots, Sharon? Because I love it so.
You love it so. Do you know what? I must confess, dermatologists, they love to pick skin too, so I must confess. But I think spot picking is not so traumatic if it's perfectly ripe and it's about to burst anyway. Mm. The problem is if you're trying to pop them when they're at the very early stage, they're quite deep under the skin and you're really being quite forceful to try and get it out of your skin. So you're digging your nails into the skin, you're deepening the level of trauma and potentially therefore scarring and pigmentation, which can last for a long, long time, more so if you're dark skinned. And of course, there's that trauma to the skin and potentially introducing some infection via your nails. So, you know, ideally not.
It's so satisfying. I know. If you're on your own and you've got a big boil, you just think, oh, give it a squeeze.
Well, funnily enough, I was lying on the sofa last night and I noticed I had a massive boil on my inner thigh.
Yes.
So I invited my other half, Sue. We boiled up a pin, right? Genuinely, boiled up a pin, got a little bit of TCP, popped it.
And went for it.
It was marvellous.
But I suspect that was the, you know, at the peak of the volcano. So it came out quite quickly.
It's better than a box set. Now, onto something a lot more serious, actually. But we really should also talk about the risk of skin cancer. Mm-hmm. Now, we know that we should be on the lookout for moles on our body and changes in the shape of moles. Can you explain the difference between a normal mole or freckle and something that is a little bit more sinister?
It's probably easier to target what is actually what you need to look out for if it's abnormal. And we often use the acronym ABCDE, which you've probably heard of. So when we advise people to self-check their moles, and I normally advise patients to do it every 3 months or so, you systematically go through each section of your skin. Now, that seems like a very daunting task because your skin is such a massive organ. But I tell the patients, take one section of skin at a time. So take your fingertips to your elbows, then elbows to shoulders. Just do one section at a time and you do a visual scan. And what you're asking yourself is, first of all, does anything stand out? It's what we call the ugly duckling sign. It's very crude, but it's the mole that stands out of the crowd. Mm. More objectively, if you wanted to look at individual moles, we use the ABCDE acronym. A stands for asymmetry. So if you put a line through that mole, are the two halves the same? If not, do get that asymmetrical mole checked out. B is the border. So are the edges of the mole nice and distinct and crisp? Or is it really quite fuzzy and blending into the background skin? C is colour. So if there are more than two colours in the mole. D is diameter. We often use a cutoff of 7 millimetres or more. So if you have a larger mole, then do get that checked out too. And E is evolution. So are any pre-existing moles changing in size, shape or colour? Or have you developed a new mole that is continuing to change? So that's the acronym that we use. And we advise patients to use that when they're self-checking.
Also, if it's itchy, is that right?
Not always. Okay. But certainly if you notice that is a new thing for your mole, get it checked out. Okay. But equally, on the flip side, you can develop melanomas without it causing any symptoms at all, which is why places that you can't see, like the back and the back of your legs, etc., it's a risky site.
How often should we be checking our skin then?
I say once every 3 months. And it does seem like a daunting task, but actually after the first few goes, you start to know what's normal for your skin and therefore you will notice what's changed. And it's really that's the key.
Now, obviously, we are Brits. And we've had a really, really, really hot summer.
Yes.
And I think we're all guilty of, you know, having just run out into the sun with very little protection and just completely overexcited about how hot it's been. What should we be doing in terms of protecting ourselves in the sun? I know we talked about having that broad spectrum sun protection. Mm-hmm. Anything else?
I think people don't put sunscreen on correctly. They put it on once in the day and that's it. If you're actually going to be really good with it, you are supposed to be putting it on 2 hourly, more so if you're in the water. So actually, I think we're all guilty of not putting on enough sunscreen. So choosing the right sunscreen, using enough of it and using it frequently enough, but also don't forget about the things like the hats, the sunglasses. You know, if you have got very sensitive skin and you are of type 1 or type 2 skin, which means that you've got very fair hair, fair skin, freckles, you're that much more sensitive to the sun. So don't forget about things like long sleeve, loose clothing, but also staying out of direct sunlight between the peak hours of 11 to 3.
Well, Denise, I mean, you are blonde and fair-skinned, aren't you? Do you like the sun? Do you
love it? I'm such a sun. I love the sun. Yeah. But I have to say, I thought I was being careful by putting SPF 50 on, but I need to check, obviously, the brands that I'm buying. But I'm more cautious now. I'm very careful. Yeah. I do wear a big hat. Don't really put my face in the sun. I prefer to use fake tans now rather than sit and sunbathe for hours. I haven't got the patience anymore.
That's true.
I can't be bothered.
Well, so whereas you and I used to sort of, you know, smash the sunbeds in the 90s, are they safe?
No, there's no such thing as a safe sunbed or a safe suntan. Because actually, if you think about what happens on a cellular level when you tan, it's your skin recruiting more pigment cells to absorb the UV. So it's already your skin telling you, I need help. So a tan, there is no such thing as a safe tan. And so it's interesting, actually, because I did a corporate talk not that long ago on sun safety. And I opened up this talk with an open question of how do you use sunscreen, and had the most... you know, shocking answers. One of them was like, well, I'll wait till I go red before I put my sunscreen on. And it's just like, well, you know, clearly the messages aren't getting through. And people are still using sunbeds, unfortunately.
And also, when you put sun cream on, how long does it take for it to actually work?
How long
is it instant?
No, it's not absolutely instant. So we normally say a good sort of 15, 20 minutes before you step out.
But is it toxic, though? Because I know that there's been news stories around the idea that putting on, you know, lots of
chemical sunscreen
onto your body is a problem. So is it toxic?
Well, there's been no studies so far that have shown cause and effect. And if people are very cautious about potentially putting too much of the chemical sunscreens, then go for a mineral blocker. And I certainly would recommend mineral blockers in children where they've got much more sensitive skin, or people who have eczema or eczema-prone skin. Then go for mineral blockers, which will be titanium dioxide. So they're using the minerals to reflect the light off, as opposed to chemicals, which are usually benzones that absorb the UV.
But in a mineral blocker, are you effectively just painting yourself white?
There is that. Yes, there is. They are a little bit more pasty, a little bit whiter.
But hey, it works.
And the benefits are great.
Kids don't care, though, do they?
No, exactly. Well, should we move on to hair? Because obviously we talked about skin and how you get great skin and how you manage skin conditions. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about hair and hair loss. Now, men know that there is a chance that they may well lose their hair, particularly as they age. But we know as well that women can too. So what on earth causes women in particular to lose their hair?
So in both sexes, the commonest cause of hair loss is genetic hair loss, or common balding. It's been given lots of different terms. So in men, it's called male pattern balding. In women, it's called female pattern hair loss. But it is genetic hair loss. And as we talked earlier, there are multiple genes involved. The problem is that with women, when you tend to get female pattern hair loss, it's usually when in your 40s and 50s. I have a number of patients who have unfortunately developed quite advanced female pattern hair loss in their 30s and even in their early 20s. They're exceptions. Majority about 40s and 50s. But of course, around that time is when you go through a lot of the hormonal changes. So on its own, just the hormonal change with you having slightly more male hormone in your body will exacerbate that diffuse thinning, loss of volume, shedding, and it will just make any underlying genetic risk even worse.
So what can women do about it if they are suffering with some baldness? Can you reverse it?
Yeah, certainly in the early stages, if you're noticing that you're starting to go thin, and the typical pattern is a diffuse area of thinning on the crown with some shedding, very early stages can actually be improved with topical products that you can buy over the counter. So
really?
The licensed products, like, for example, Regain is licensed for female pattern hair loss. And that can help first and foremost to slow down it, progression, but it can, in a percentage of people, actually improve regrowth as well. And then beyond that, you're talking about tablets, which all have an anti-hormonal, anti-testosterone type effect. And of course, they're never risk-free. So the discussions would be about possibly taking HRT, if they're premenopause, or maybe thinking about the contraceptive pill, all these things which have an anti-testosterone effect. But it has to sit well with that patient taking it. They're not risk-free medications.
And can stress and trauma really make your hair fall out?
Yes.
Or is that a myth?
No, absolutely true. So your hair follicles go through a life cycle. So it goes through different stages. It goes through a growing phase, a resting phase, and then a shedding phase. And when you shed an old hair, you just get replace another one. And it just happens cyclically throughout your entire life. What happens when you undergo a lot of stress is that you shunt out the hairs in the growing phase quicker than they should be. So you suddenly get all these hairs transiting through to the shedding phase more so than normal. So then you'll see it in the shower, you'll see it on your brush, on your pillow, and with that comes a volume reduction.
Is that the same when you've had a child as well,
yes,
after pregnancy?
Yes, it's so the actual condition is called telogen effluvium, and emotional stress, mm-hmm. Hormonal fluctuations like postpartum, hormone changes can all upset that cycle of the hair follicle and cause telogen effluvium.
But you are meant to lose hairs, though.
Yes.
I mean, so what's a normal amount of shedding? So if you're in the yes. shower and your plug hole fills up,
yeah.
you know, how many hairs should we be shedding every day?
Yes, so you have on average about 100 to 150,000 hair follicles
on your
scalp.
Head?
Yep. Yep. So you can, and it can be normal for a person to shed anywhere between 50 and about 100 hairs a day.
I'm going to start counting.
No, please don't start counting.
We have to include our beards as well.
That's
now.
That's true. That's true. And of course, the extensive pubic hair. Gosh. Okay. So, if in doubt, don't be too alarmed if your plug hole is filling up. But it is. It's quite normal during stages of hormone disruption, basically, to perhaps lose a little bit more of your hair.
Sure. And of course, with hair loss, it's such a personal subject. Mm. If it bothers you to that point, you'd like to take treatment further, then you should go and see a dermatologist, a trichologist.
Can I just ask a very quick question, actually, before we do wrap up? Mm. If you are suffering with dandruff,
yes.
so clearly that is also a skin condition,
yes.
isn't it?
Yes.
What causes dandruff? Is that just having dirty hair or having too much product in your hair, or what causes it?
Well, those things don't help. They can exacerbate underlying dandruff, but it does not mean that it's a lack of hygiene or washing or anything like that. Dandruff is actually just dead skin cells, and what's creating that is actually normal yeasts that sit on our skin. We've all got these yeasts called Malassezia, more so where you've got hair follicles. So we've got them in abundance in our scalp. In some people, they react to the byproducts that are released from these yeasts. So these yeasts feed off our own natural oils in the skin. And the byproducts which land on our skin, some people are sensitive to that. And so what happens is it stimulates the cells to turn over too quickly, and that's when you accumulate dead skin cells.
This podcast, I'm learning so much. Well, I could talk about this all day, but Denise Van Outen and Dr. Sharon Wan, thank you both very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You can find out more about what we've talked about in this episode in the show notes, which you can find at hcahealthcare.co.uk/podcast. Why not click subscribe on your podcast app to get future episodes for free, downloaded onto your phone when they're released? And while you're there, if you could also take a second to rate us or leave a review, that would A, be really kind, and it'll help others find the podcast more easily. Health, Fact versus Fiction is presented by me, Anna Richardson, and is a Bengo Media production for HCA Healthcare UK.